We know that Ur-Nammu was responsible for these ziggurats because his name is inscribed on the mud bricks that are used to construct them. The ziggurat at Ur is one of the best preserved of this type of structure. If you remember when Leonard Woolley excavated at Ur, it was because the ziggurat was still visible in the area. The ziggurat was placed in a walled-off structure, which itself was raised on a platform, so the entire temple precinct is above the rest of the city. Two of three stories of the ziggurat are preserved, and they now stand about 60 feet high on a foundation that spreads about 200 by 150 feet. There are three long stairways on the northeast side of the ziggurat, one in the center and one on each side, and these provide access to a landing between the first and second levels of the ziggurat. The central staircase would have continued up to the top level, giving access to the shrine that would have originally stood at the top of the ziggurat. If you see a reconstruction of a ziggurat, it probably draws on Ur-Nammu's ziggurat at Ur for its model. So you will become quite familiar with Ur-Nammu's ziggurat. Both the written and the archaeological evidence for Ur-Nammu's reign describe his attention to rebuilding and restoring temples, and also to his work freeing his people from thieves, robbers, and rebels. And these would have been the invaders that came from different parts of the borders of Mesopotamia, and he had to reopen the highways to make them safe for his people to travel, and also to restore the trade that was so important to the Mesopotamian economy. It comes as something of a surprise with all of this focus on Ur-Nammu's religious activity that we learn that he died in battle. An inscription records that he was abandoned on the battlefield like a smashed vessel. And it is very rare for a Mesopotamian ruler to die in battle. So when it happens, both the sources note it, usually as a way to describe punishment for some impious action that he's taken. That's not the case for Ur-Nammu, but it does cause quite a bit of concern for his successors and for his people to learn that a king could die in battle. We have the most complete evidence for the Ur III period during the long reign of Ur-Nammu's son Shulgi, who ruled from 2094 to 2047 BC. A number of sources attest to Shulgi's success and allow us to trace the major events in his reign, mostly in the area of his governance and bureaucratic control of Babylonia. The earliest collection of royal laws, just a few fragments, are attributed to either Shulgi or to his father Ur-Nammu. These laws show the involvement of the king in ensuring justice for his people, and we'll come to this concept in a later lecture when we discuss the law code of Hammurabi. Diplomatic negotiations, specifically marriage with families of powerful neighboring states, are attested for the Ur III period, and these would increase both the size and the prosperity of the kingdom. Shulgi himself had 9 wives, including a princess from Maring, the wealthy trading center on the northern Euphrates. And if you recall, the Akkadian kings, Sargon and Naram-Sin, attacked these cities as a way to control them. Shulgi now returns to a more diplomatic alliance with the region, probably because it was so difficult to control an area far from the heartland of his kingdom. One of the most important domestic reforms enacted by Shulgi was the creation of an elaborate, unified bureaucracy that joined southern and northern Babylonia. This bureaucracy is known from the extensive record keeping that preserves a standardized system of weights and measures, a new calendar, and the administrative and military hierarchy of the court.